When I was old enough to swing a hammer, he taught me how to drive. Hammers into nails, nails into boards, boards into halls that lined houses. And I learned that good things are built at the hands of honest men. But I also learned that we build the world that we inhabit in. Now I feel bad if I sleep past 10, knowing the old man's still kicking my tail before my feet hit the floor. I don't want to fail to make more than average. I want to sketch out this web that we want to weave. I want to see the ideas inside my head leave my head, stretch their legs, walk around, rub up against people in the morning commute. I want to see them commune with people around water coolers and joke with coworkers. I want to sweat work ethic, like my dad sweated work ethic, so that every time I hug people, I get a little on people, and eventually it soaks through people, so we can start to live these dreams by incarnate means, and eventually we can all start changing the world. My name is Joshua. I'm really happy to be here. I hope you're having a good time at Circle so far. I know that I am. If you need any suggestions for where to get tacos in Dallas, I have no shortage of opinions. I lived here for a year, and we can talk tacos all day. But really today I want to talk to you about magic, which might seem like a strange topic for a conference. But you know magic, and I want you to stop being such a terrible wizard. I grew up in a small town in South Carolina, population about 3,000. When I was growing up, there's 2,000 people there now. We had one stoplight. There's three now. They're bustling metropolis. Hardee's that I would eat at pretty much every morning before high school, and a small diner, 24/7 diner called Lou and Perry's. I would sneak out of my house at night when my parents were asleep, and I would ride my bike down the middle of Main Street because nobody was out. And I would go and hustle people for money playing pool at Lou and Perry's. And then I would use this money to buy comic books or glass bottle Cokes or those little chocolate donuts that are waxy that you buy at gas stations. Comics really started to help shape a lot of my vocabulary at a young age. They started to shape a lot of my worldview, which might seem like a strange thing, but you gotta understand, I grew up in a town of 3,000 people. Like, it doesn't make sense that I do what I do. It doesn't make sense that I'm here, that you paid money to come and hear people like me speak. But what does make sense is that our worldview gets shaped by all of these strange things that we encounter. I went to public school in the state that regularly dukes it out with Mississippi for 49th or 50th in education and literacy. Most of the people that I grew up with never left. And that's not a knock on them as much as it is a nod to this bizarre world that we live in, where somebody like me from small town South Carolina can learn what I've learned and get to do what I do and have this platform to like talk to you and to talk to people online. So the way that comics played into that, I would buy, you know, Captain America at the gas station, and they'd carry Captain America for like 8 issues, and I'd get really into that story, and then they'd decide they were going to carry the Avengers, and I'd be sad or whatever, and I'd never know what happened to Captain America fighting whoever. Eventually, it turned into this, I want to know. So I found there was a comic book store in the big city near us, which was about 35,000 people. And I turned my little comic book hobby into a $100 a month comic book habit when comics still costed a dollar a piece. I would eventually start buying baseball cards in bulk from a tobacco reseller. And then I would use my mom's tax ID number to get wholesale prices. And then I'd resell packs to kids at school for a markup so that I could go and buy comic books. But you gotta understand that for me, it wasn't as much about escapism, because a lot of us read fiction for escapism, as it was about wanting to know more about the world and getting to see this picture of a world that was beyond what I dealt with in the day-to-day. This is a relatively new picture of Hell's Kitchen. It's a small neighborhood in Midtown, west side of the island of Manhattan. Prior to the 90s, it was a pretty rough place to be. And I knew where Hell's Kitchen was when I was in, like, I don't know, second grade? Which doesn't really make sense for a kid from South Carolina. But, and I'd never traveled to New York. My parents are working class, great folks, but I'd been to North Carolina and South Carolina and Virginia at that point in my life. This was before the internet. This was before I developed this crazy habit I have now where I want to know everything, so I spend all day on Wikipedia or in the library. Mostly, I knew about Hell's Kitchen because of this guy. Daredevil was my favorite comic book growing up, and his alter ego is, you know, this guy named, blind lawyer named Matt Murdock. He's basically a pro bono lawyer by day, gritty, vigilante, ninja-trained acrobat superhero by night, and he lived and worked and heroed in Hell's Kitchen in New York. And so as a seven-year-old, an eight-year-old, I start having this knowledge of the island of Manhattan, the neighborhoods in Manhattan, what goes on there. I got to inhabit his world, even if it was only for 25 or 30 pages a month. I got to live in something that someone else lived in. And for me, that was magic. For me as a kid from a small town who didn't get to interact with much beyond going to the hardware store with my dad on Saturday mornings and talking shop with old dudes who did that every week, I got to be transported to this other world. And yeah, there were superheroes in it, which doesn't exist, but New York was real. Hell's Kitchen was real. Learning about all of that was real. This helped me shape a lot of knowing what I didn't want. I didn't want to stay where I was. I didn't want to work in a mill or a factory or work construction with my dad like I did growing up. I wanted to see the world and know more about the world, and I wanted to help shape the world because I saw that there were these comic book illustrators who were creating worlds. They were like willing these things into being, and then I got to kind of inhabit it for a little while. For the last 10 years, I've been a professional graphic designer. I work in that 10 years, primarily I've been at New Spring Church, solving problems and creating solutions that create problems that we have to solve again, and generally just trying to work with this team to create a really good visual and systems framework for people that come to our church, that are involved in our church. I've gotten to watch New Spring grow from a 500-person startup church that everybody kind of patted on the head and said was cute, but that'll never work, to I think we had about 20,000 people at church last weekend. Between all the multiple campuses we have, we're all over the state of South Carolina now, and we continue to grow. The team that I work with has grown from me to 12 people, project managers and web developers and designers and this other whole set of volunteers that we try and pour into and that are doing the work of the ministry of our church alongside paid staff. We work on websites, wireframes, copy, code, signs, conferences, apparel, you name it. We get to do it. We have this like giant playground almost of things to create for and to create with. But generally what we're trying to do is we want to make it better. We want to make whatever we touch better than it was before we touched it. In addition to trying to improve things at New Spring, like a lot of you, I work with clients sometimes. I'm currently working with a fledgling jeans company trying to improve what they do, and I'm working with a old hippie dude from my church who wants to start a lifestyle brand for camping, and he's a great copywriter, and he takes me out to lunch at Waffle House whenever we have business meetings. It's awesome. In addition to that, my wife and I are hopefully opening this brick and mortar home goods store next month. which is crazy and has had all these other interesting things involved with it. But in my spare time, I have, I think, what is perhaps my most important and most taxing and most frustrating and really not even rewarding role, which is parental tech support. You might have heard of this. You might have had to participate in it at some point. It's sort of like working for the Geek Squad, but you don't get a car or you get paid, and it's terrible. And you just swim in a sea of ever-increasing ignorance. I think we've all been there, on the phone, trying to figure out why your mom just can't seem to grasp that there's a help menu at the top right-hand side of every window on her computer. Or how it's possible for your dad to rename the hard drive to a 52-character string of alphanumeric characters and gibberish again. But parental tech support is the essence of magic, of the kind of magic that I want to talk about today, of what I want to share with you. Those exchanges that you have with your parents or your family, however frustrating they are, however many four-letter words you mutter under your breath while you're trying to sort this thing out, they sum up everything about why we do what we do and how we can be good at it. Because really, the essence of parental tech support is those who know magic help those help others who don't. My parents are smart people. They've raised two capable children. They are still alive. They're retirees now, so they were successful in business. But they can't grasp some of the stuff that happens in this little box that sits on their desk. But I can. And so to them, it's kind of like magic. I can just fix things. Because really, it doesn't do you much good if you have these magical powers and you're a wizard, but you don't have an audience, and you don't share any tricks with anybody. So if you're going to make things, most of us in the room are making things. We're going to create things or design things or code things or write things or event plan things or any number of things that we're trying to bring into the world that didn't exist before. If we're going to do that, we have to understand a fundamental principle about how the world works and how different this group of people is. Arthur C. Clarke was a British science fiction writer. He's probably most widely known for writing a book called 2001: A Space Odyssey, which became one of the most influential science fiction movies of all time. So Clarke had these three laws that he talked about for probability and science, really, and kind of they encapsulated his view of the world. His third law is that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Indistinguishable. So it's like completely unable to be noticed as different. Like to the average person walking the street, it's apples to apples. So to most of the world, whatever you do, whether it's sitting down to code a website or create a banner or make a sign or make an app or create a typeface or draw a picture, whatever it is, if they can't do it, they probably don't even have a framework to understand it. So it might as well be magic. It's so sufficiently advanced from what they can do that, I mean, it might as well be, you know, creating things out of thin air. Because to them, that's what it is. Whatever you're gifted and good at, whatever you love to do, whatever you're driven to do day to day, if somebody else isn't wired up the same way that you are, they don't have a framework for understanding the like the magicalness of what you do. And while we might know that it's not really magic, it's just a set of applied skills or it's just a new technology, and we understand the underlying things, they don't. They don't get that. It reminds me of these guys. This is Bill S. Preston, Esquire, and Ted Theodore Logan from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So you think about them like introducing the futuristic technological magic of time travel to this host of historical figures. Just showing up and wooing Genghis Khan into their time traveling phone booth with a Twinkie, I think. That's some pretty excellent magic to most of the world. And for us, this is still excellent magic because time travel doesn't exist, but it might. Or this guy. This is one of my favorite anti-heroes in cinema. If you've ever watched any of the Evil Dead movies, this is Ash. And in Evil Dead 3, he gets transported back to the Middle Ages in his Oldsmobile, but he's still got his rifle, and he's still got gunpowder. And so he gets to introduce this black magic of gunpowder to medieval peasants. He calls it his boomstick. But really what that highlights is that most magic is simply a matter of timing. It's a matter of over time, you can learn pretty much anything about the world that you have the brain capacity to learn, and it's going to lose some of its luster because it's not magic to you anymore because you understand it. If you showed up in medieval London driving a PT Cruiser, they'd probably burn you at the stake and destroy your, you know, hellish hell beast of a vehicle and think that you're a witch. If you showed up in downtown Grapevine today driving a PT Cruiser, I'd just make fun of you because it's an ugly car. it's really just a matter of timing. It's a matter of knowledge and gaining this stuff. John Cleese said, to know that you how good you are at something requires the same skills as it does to be good at the thing. So if you're absolutely hopeless at something, you lack exactly the skills that you need to know that you're absolutely hopeless at it. So we know, trade secret, we know we don't know magic, right? Like, I mean, some of you might actually legit know magic, but I don't know magic, really. I know how to build websites. I know how to solve problems visually. I know how to make copy clear and concise. I know how to help clients and brands interact with their customers in better ways. I know how to help build social interactions on the web. Most people I deal with don't know how to do those things. And no amount of me talking, no amount of me educating necessarily is ever going to change the fact that they just think I like poof these things into existence. But that's fine. You know, for you, you know you don't know magic. You know you just have some skills. You know how to do some things. You know technology. Everyone else thinks you're a wizard, and that's fine. You might self-identify as, I know I'm just a designer. I know I'm just a developer. I know I just build some stuff. I just took some classes. I just learned some HTML. I'm just naturally wired up to make pretty stuff. That might be how you self-identify, but for most of the world, you're a wizard, man. And the problem is that we just get used to our own skills. We live in this echo chamber where we tend to hang out with people that are like us. We come to conferences like this, and it's inspiring, and it's great. But we're so used to it. Like, imagine that you work at Disney, and you're the chief fireworks officer of Disney. Your job is to make that fireworks show the most amazing thing that it can possibly be. My nephew and my niece are going to Disney this week for the first time. And I know they're going to see this fireworks show. Well, if you're the chief fireworks officer at Disney and you've been there long enough to rise through the fireworks rank from, you know, fireworks serf to fireworks, you know, CEO, whatever, if you've been there that long, you're probably like in a corner of the castle playing words with friends while the finale's going on because you're so sick of fireworks. You've seen all the fireworks for a lifetime. Most people see fireworks once a year. You know, most kids who go to Disney for the first time have never seen anything the scale of this kingdom lit up and all these like millions of created stars lighting the sky. They've never seen that. Their mind is being expanded. Their worldview is being expanded. And the chief fireworks officer is, you know, trying to get a triple letter score because that's more interesting to him. We have these skills, we have this magic, we have these things that other people don't have, and we're so used to it, we just kind of get bored. It becomes habit. Tim Berners-Lee said that everything that you don't understand is magic. My wife sews, she's amazing at sewing. I brutalize a sewing machine from time to time. I still don't quite understand how the bottom stitch and the top stitch work. Like, my mind hasn't quite wrapped around. It's still kind of like, I mean, it's just magic, right? Like, it just works. Somebody just invented it. I don't know how it works. Tim Berners-Lee, for the folks that don't know, created the World Wide Web. It's a pretty nice invention. A world that didn't exist. A connection between all these other worlds that did exist. And for him, he understands how the internet works. I don't. I build stuff for it. There's so many levels and depths of things and servers and DNS stuff and propagating and this whole set of jargon and terms and technologies. It might as well be that there are fairies in my computer, like, ferrying messages back and forth between the world. I don't know. So it might as well be magic. But once we understand, meh. It's like ancient Israel. They're led out of the promised land, or led out of Egypt, into the promised land. They have these amazing cases of divine intervention happen where seas part and rivers part. They have this whole safe, dry passage. And they get to the promised land and they're like, eh. And they just forget. Like, they just forget, just like gone. And I don't want to forget. I don't want for us to forget that when you make your mom's email work, she doesn't understand how you did that. So it might as well be magic to her. When you create a client's website and it drives their business up, it makes all their graphs go up and to the right, it might as well be magic to them. When you write clear copy that concisely captures your value proposition to the world, for somebody that can't write more than a grocery list, that's magical to them. When you come up with a new idea that nobody else on your team or nobody else that you're interacting with has come up with, that's magic. When you do what comes easily to you, it's still hard work. Nobody in here is going to say it's not hard work, but you know some things just come easily to you. I can make pretty stuff without much effort because I've got a lot of hours put in and I'm just naturally bent towards that way. So when you do the things that you can't imagine not doing, it's pretty magical to everybody else in the world. So I'm here to remind you that you do know magic. Like, you just need to accept the fact that no amount of convincing is ever going to convince people that you don't have special skills that they don't have. And that doesn't necessarily make any of us special in the sense that we're better than anyone, but it does make us necessary. There is a need in the world for everyone in this room to make things better than they were before they touched them. It's like Uncle Ben in Spider-Man comics saying, with great power comes great responsibility. Like, you've got great power. You have power that no one else has, and it's set up in a unique way that's unique to you and will solve and help in unique ways out in the world. And if you know that you're gifted, however you believe that happened, whether you just think you're awesome or you think it's dumb luck or you think it was handed down to you from on high, if you're gifted and you don't use that for good reasons, then your talent, your magic just terminates with you. You just don't help. You don't change anything really that can affect change. Selfish magic can be really wasted magic if you're not careful. So maybe it would be helpful if we had a bit of a role model for some of this. So we'll pick everybody's favorite. Nobody doesn't like Gandalf, right? So he's ridiculously powerful. Like, I'm going to nerd out for a second and just talk about some of the Lord of the Rings stuff that my wife nerds out to me on date night sometimes and talks to me about because she studied it in college, and that's not throwing her under the bus. I think it's really sexy. She's told me all this stuff about the Lord of the Rings world. So, like, Gandalf's not even really a wizard. He's actually this other race of beings that's been around forever, but he's so powerful, and he's so popular with the ladies. He's got all this stuff going for him. Like, seriously, do you remember when he fights the Balrog? I'm like a hefty dude. Like, I think I could probably take most of the people in here. This guy would turn me into a s'more in like 8 seconds. So Gandalf fights him and wins. Like, he wins that tussle. He's got all this ancient power, this ancient wisdom, all this stuff going for him, almost limitless, and he uses it to serve people. He uses it to sacrifice for his friends. He uses it, and he goes the way that that all good wizards should go, really, which is to like work and play well with others. And he does this for people, and he does this for causes that matter, that he believes in. He could do anything, you know? He could be off running his own kingdom, but he believes in something greater than that. I believe John Piper tweeted yesterday or today, something along the lines of, if you don't find a cause to pour yourself into, then you're your cause. You're it. That's it. If you don't find someplace to use all this talent you have, it's going to end with you. And I don't know about you, but I'm pretty lame most of the time, and I don't really want my talent to be wasted just on me. When you craft and you create and you make things, you create worlds that didn't exist. Like, I think about the internet being created. Like, people made that. Like, and I take it for granted that maybe it's just always existed, even though I know I'm old enough to know that it didn't always exist. But that world, all the things that have happened in that world, all the things that we do, the jobs that we have, the businesses that we run, how much of that rests and is because of the catalyst of this creation of this world? So I want to talk about technology a little bit. Just so the wheel gets invented in like 4000 BC. The sailboat's like 3200 BC. Middle Ages, you get horseshoes, you get wheelbarrows, you get all these things that are like progressively making work easier, making travel more possible. You get simple machines like the pulley and the cork. You get clocks, windmills. Thankfully, there are no PT Cruisers. You move into the Renaissance, you get printing presses, you get the scientific method, which comes in pretty handy. And then we move into the Industrial Age, and we have steam-powered things. We have electricity, we have the telegraph and the telephone, and eventually nuclear fission and weapons and power. We've got the radio and television, the internet, powered flight, space travel. On our fifth anniversary trip, we took a road trip up the North Carolina and Virginia coast. And out in Kitty Hawk, you can go to these dunes in Kill Devil Hills in North Carolina, and you can see the Wright Brothers Memorial. And I didn't think it would be that awesome, but it was, because you see where these guys, like, they've got this amazing sculpture with where they took off and where they landed on their first flight, and then where they landed on their second flight, and then way down this field where they landed on their third and fourth flight. And you get the physicalness of this invention of human flight. Wilbur Wright said, "I confess that in 1901, I said to my brother, men would not fly for 50 years. 2 years later, they were making flights. 66 years later, depending on who you ask, we landed a man on the moon." Like, let that sink in for a second. Like, I left my house in Greenville yesterday and flew here in a plane. And that didn't exist 100 years ago. This entire system of travel was a world that was impossible. Like, you want to go to Dallas? Load up your wagon, have fun, don't die, you know? Like, like, I love tacos, but I don't want to die for tacos, so I probably would have stayed in Greenville, you know? But we built that. Like, humans, like us, built the entire world of air travel. We built airplanes. We built these computers that can control and know where airplanes are so they don't run into each other. The internet was built. This building was built, and we've got a little bit more of a grasp on that, because most of us understand, oh yeah, you stack a brick on top of another brick on top of another brick, and eventually you get a wall. Like, we can get that, but still, we made that. Like, that is an amazing thing, and it boggles my mind to think about sitting in an airplane working on this talk. How did my life get here? because people, wizards, people who thought they could do it, people who thought that there was more to the world than what existed, willed it. They put effort forth. They worked hard. They sweated. And they got there. And then we go from something that's magical to something that's an annoying commodity in a handful of years. Oh, air travel, it's the most horrible thing. Like, I'm sure you've all seen the clip of the comedian talking about, like, you're in a chair in the sky. We should all be like, ah, the whole time. But once we understand something, the magic's kind of gone. Like, NASA landed an SUV with cameras on it on Mars a couple of weeks ago by remote control with a parachute and tiny little rockets that set it gently down on the surface of Mars. If that doesn't blow your mind at what humankind is capable of creating, what kind of worlds exist that we can't get to because we haven't created the worlds that are the catalyst to get there yet. If that doesn't just blow your mind and make you want to make stuff, you should probably go work at Starbucks. But we forget, you know, we settle in. That's humankind. We get comfy. We get entitled. We just forget that stuff didn't exist. We forget that the world can always be improving. This is one of my life rules right here. Don't complain about what you permit. So I have some skills that I can use to improve the world around me. If I don't like the way my yard looks, I can change that. That's a little chunk of dominion that I can have over the world. I know the people that build the apps that I use every day to improve my life. I've gotten to know them and be in relationship with them. They're not like superheroes. They're not really wizards, but there's this like magical brick with the sum of all human knowledge in my pocket. And some of you are, you know, looking at it and looking at Twitter right now, which is cool. Like, no judgment. But the fact that didn't exist, but that people that I know made it, people that I know participated in the creation of a world that changed everything about how I kind of see my day to day. And the people in this room, all of you, all of us, will shape the future. It might not be all of it, you know, obviously, but you'll shape some part of it. What you build will have ripple effects on the world, not just that you live in, but the world that everybody lives in. And it doesn't feel like that when I'm cursing at Photoshop, because it's not really unexpected when it crashes, so stop telling me that. It's a horrible piece of copywriting. And it doesn't feel like that when I'm struggling to pay my bills, and it doesn't feel like that when I'm trying to figure out how to deal with this client, and it doesn't feel like that in the day-to-day most of the time. I don't feel like I'm creating the future. I feel like I am struggling in the present, for lack of a better metaphor. But it's interesting, like, I've been at New Spring for almost the whole life of this church. And I'm like, I get to be the ultimate embodiment of this in-house designer thing, because I create frameworks or systems or designs, and then I live in them because that's my church. These are my people that I wanna help. And so if I, hypothetically, create a logo that's kind of hard to deal with, so that hypothetically every designer on our team might have the conversation every day about whether it should be visually centered or mathematically centered. We have to live with that because we made it. This is this world that we inhabit. We created it. We built it, top to bottom. If we don't pay attention to the kerning on the typography on our sign standards for the rest of the time I'm at that church, I'm going to hate that sign because I have to live. Not just in it, I have to live with it all the time. We probably don't feel like we're building. Maybe that's too much of like a macro or a micro view of it because I'm like so close to it. But when you build something and put it out into the world, like it exists for people to interact with. It's part of somebody's world. Is it good? Does it make their life better than it was? Or does it suck? And if it does, then why did you create it? Because it's your world too. Like, that's like littering. Like, don't do that. If again, it's not just about us and the things that we see. If a guest comes to one of the New Spring campuses and they're doing the pee-pee dance in the atrium because my wayfinding signage is terrible and doesn't tell them where the restrooms were, that's not a world that I want to live in, much less a world that I want them to live in. I'm trying to love them. I want them to be welcome in our environment and stay and learn and grow. And so if I can't help meet the most basic of their needs at the moment that they meet it, because that's what I do, I'm a designer, I'm supposed to make life easier on them. If I can't do that, it's not just unloving. I've created like this inhospitable world for them to live in. And it's an inhospitable world for me to live in too. So if you want to love people, if you want to serve people, and if you want to love yourself and you want to serve yourself to an extent, you need to build things. We need to build things that are the world that we want to exist. If we don't want it to exist, don't create it. Don't put it out into public view. You populate these worlds that we create. It's like a real world game of Sims. If you remember Sims. You populate it with your vision and with your output. You can control the landscape of it. You can control the weather. It's like you're the gatekeeper and the groundskeeper of this world that you create. You get to be the CEO and the janitor, or the landlord and the tenant. And when you create these things, they have this ripple effect that goes out and affects other people. When you create stuff, when you make stuff, it throws shrapnel. Like, it throws sparks. That's going to affect other people. And affecting other people is great if it's affecting them for good, if it's affecting them for the change that you want to happen. It's not even as much about what do I want the world to look like. It's what does the world need to look like? I had a conversation with a friend who's a designer, and he's got this developer that wants to build an iOS app with him, and he's like, what should we build? And I'm like, do you not have any problems in your life? Like, is everything in your side of the world rosy? Like, build something that solves a legit need that exists in the world. You've got all this talent. You've got time. You want me to give you my laundry list of things that I hate about life that I want to improve and I want to make better? You can go and build that app for me. That would be great. What do you think the world needs to look like around you? Where can you affect change? Why aren't you building that? What's holding you back from building the things that can improve your life, can improve the lives of the people around you, and make this whole thing better? You've got all these skills, and all you got to do is start casting some spells and making some stuff happen. I'm 33. The average life expectancy for a white American male is 75 years now. Went up just a little bit recently. That means, all things being equal, statistically, I have about 42 years left, which is kind of sobering. I went to public school, so my math might be approximate, but it's about 500 months or 15,000 weeks, 107,000 days. So if I take a day off every week and I go on vacation and take my wife someplace nice every year a couple of times, I've got about 90,000 days to work. To build stuff. If nothing else happens statistically, 90,000 days to will worlds into being and wield these like creative weapons that I've been given and that I've been trying to hone and that I want to use for good. Tomorrow, I'll have 89,999 days left. And that clock just keeps rolling because I'm limited. There's only so much that I can do. There's only so much that I can focus on. If I take every project that comes my way, I'm going to be a mile wide and an inch deep, and then I'm going to die. And I'm also going to have no integrity because I'm not serving anyone in the greater community of design well. So I have to choose carefully. I don't want to waste. If I've got skills, if I've got magic, if I'm a wizard, I don't want to waste that. I want to use that. I want to be really, really diligent and very discerning about how I use what I've got. Because the bottom line is, we're gonna die. As my pastor likes to say, the life expectancy for everyone is approaching zero. And he's right. And whatever you believe about the afterlife, I don't really know the makeup of everybody here. If you subscribe to one of the Abrahamic faiths, you believe in some version of an afterlife, right? And it would be a pretty terrible afterlife if it wasn't the afterlife that's laid out in most religious texts, where we're free from sickness and death and sadness. No more tears, no more things that are wrong, right? That'd be a pretty terrible, it would be not awesome to get to the afterlife and be like, oh, I'd totally change that. Because that's just another version of this, right? Like, and we can all agree that things are broken. Things need mending. And if you don't believe in an afterlife, then cool, like poof, you're gone, like a vapor, like spritz, done. And whatever you believe about that, you're not going to be doing what you're doing right now after you're dead. Like, no matter how you believe that plays out, whatever life you've got left is the life you have left to do what you're doing right now, or to do some other thing that you should be doing. Your legacy might stick around for maybe a few months, a few years, if you're really, really awesome. Maybe somebody in this room does something famous and something gets named after them. But eventually, gradually, whatever you build is going to fade away. It's either going to get swallowed up by entropy, by the destruction of everything, by the slow degradation of time, or it's going to get eaten up in the vision of somebody else. Whatever you do, the work that you do, they're going to bury it with you. And so you don't need to waste time, because you don't have that much time. And maybe that's a really depressing thing to say this early in the morning, right before lunch, but I'm sure we'll get some tacos and it'll be great. But I want you to know that you don't have this ability to self-identify as what you do forever. Like, you can, I'm a designer. Well, that's great. So do you believe in the afterlife? Yeah, totally, I believe in heaven. What are you gonna do when you get there? My wife and I have some theological debates about this whole concept, but, and maybe it's an issue of semantics, but I'm like, if I can improve upon it when it's there, then it's not perfect already. Now, maybe there's work for me to do, but it's not gonna be this work. This work, this like solving problems, this desire to improve and mend and fix what is broken, limited. If you're a designer, how much time do you have left to design things? If you're a developer, how much time do you have left to build things, or to project manage things, or to create something that doesn't exist? Because the clock's ticking. Entropy is like eating the world. Everything is broken, and everything needs fixing in some variety, and the earth like groans under the weight of how bad things are. But we can help contribute to making that better. So just to sum up, if you believe that you've got skills, if you believe that you have some kind of magic that people don't understand, and you believe rightly that there's not much time for you to use that, what are you doing? Like, I know for me, I get into these conversations with people constantly. I've been at New Spring for a long time, apparently, because everybody that talks to me is like, oh, you're still there? You know, which like the implication is like, oh, you're a talented designer. Why do you still work for that church? Which for me, I'm like, this is what I want to pour my skill and my time into right now. This is what I feel like is important. This is what I want to pour my life and our family's life into right now. Otherwise, we wouldn't be there. Because I know I've got some skills, and I know that I want to steward them really, really well in the limited time that I have. So what are you doing? You know, these are some blanket statements, but the world doesn't need another Twitter app, and the world definitely doesn't need another weather app, and the world doesn't need you to go work for Facebook, and it doesn't need you to go chase money. Those are, to some extent, unless it's a unique case, those are lesser things. What is your passion? Like, what are you going to go to bed tonight and not stop being able to think about? Like, as nerdy as this sounds, I'm probably gonna lay down tonight and be like, I think my math was totally wrong on those wayfinding signs for our Columbia campus, and I need to change them. which is the dumbest thing in the entire world, but nobody else on my team thinks about that because I'm there, and I'm the one that's supposed to think about that. And these are the things that are important for me to utilize my skills to serve the people at our church. Think about what you're passionate about. Think about what you love to do. Think about what you do when you're procrastinating from doing the thing that you hate doing. That stuff is all breadcrumbs leading you to some kind of journey. It's some kind of journey. And I mean, what good is knowing magic if you don't go on a quest? If you don't use it for some reason that's a bigger cause than just you? If it ends with you, that's a tiny dream. That's a tiny quest. And it's a waste of what you're good at. I can't tell you what you're supposed to do, but you can figure it out. Other people will help you. If you believe in Jesus, the Holy Spirit will help you. You just got to ask him. Whatever you are supposed to do is out there, and nobody else is doing it because you're the one that's supposed to do it. You're the one that's supposed to will that world into being. If you don't, that world never gets created, and then worlds don't get built on top of that thing. So really, what good's being a wizard if you waste it? Just to close up, I want you to just be awed for a second, and maybe this doesn't awe you. There's no audio associated with it. I just want to show you about a 3-minute clip of a legit magician. This is a guy named Ricky J. And just let it sit. Apologize for the low quality on that. Apparently no one has willed the world into being where I can find high quality clips of Ricky J online. I could tell you how he did it, but where would the fun be in that? Thank you very much.
We've got a few minutes for some Q&A, if you're willing to stay up there. Is
sure.
That cool? All right, some Q&A for Joshua. We'll open it up. Does anyone have any? Right here.
Hello, yes, hot mic, yeah. At what point did the church realize that hiring more designers and a whole team was a great idea? Or did you kind of have to work at it?
It's changed a lot over the years. So I was first hired in 2002. I started volunteering. I basically was running sound as a volunteer. And then I was like, your bulletins kind of suck. Can I help? And they're like, yeah, sure. Do you know graphic design? I'm like, no, but I'll figure it out. So I like learned how to use Corel Draw and use the secretary's PC and would draw white boxes and cover stuff up. And they hired me part-time in 2002. And I was the only designer as we grew from about 500 people to about 3,000 people. In 2005, I was actually fired because I couldn't keep up with deadlines anymore because we'd grown so fast and we just didn't really have a nothing grows that fast without stretch marks. And I couldn't keep up. I couldn't create a system that could keep us up, but I couldn't convince my leadership at that time that we needed to hire more people. So I left in mid-2005. They ended up hiring two designers later that year to come in. I came back and was asked to come back in 2008. We had two designers when I interviewed. By the time I came in after the interview, we were back down to one designer and then me. And it just sort of, from 2008 until now, we've tried to organically grow as we keep really good systems. A lot of our leadership, not in a bad way, but analytics are something they use fairly heavily as part of their decision-making process. It's not all of their decision-making process, but we have a design request process. And therefore, I can run a report on that and be like, well, last year, we had 75 open projects during this month. This year, we have 475 open projects, which is a legit number, by the way, because I just pulled that report. So it's a little easier to say, this is the number of projects we have in. This is the number, the volume that we can actually accomplish. And if you want more than that, we've either got to hire somebody or we have to scale back. So analytics are part of that. Gut is part of that. We've hired some people when we were in the like lower seasons, but it was just like, they're the right person for the job and we want them on the team. So I don't think there's any like hard and fast, but I feel like the more information that we can equip our leadership with, we can push those decisions up to them, and then they can be informed when they make a decision, not just, man, those guys want to hire somebody else, everybody else is struggling. So for us, we've got 4 designers right now and 3 developers, and each one of those people has at least 1 volunteer that comes in and works with them during the week. And so we can say, hey, we've got 14 people doing design work right now and we can't keep up. And we're trying to utilize volunteers, we're doing the best that we can. And then we push that decision up to them.
Yeah, I'm the art director at a church your size as well. And you said tickets and everything else. We're doing systems that are pretty much insane to keep up with. And we run about 4,000 requests a year right now. And so I've only been here 45 days. I'm actually East Coast guy on your side. So, but anyway, what are y'all using at NewSpring now? Because I know...
You're not going to like the answer to this question.
I know because... Well, I talked to Ken Wilson and I'm like, Google, really? And...
Yeah, and so our video team and our like design and communications teams are separate teams just because that's how we've grown. I had a good conversation with the director of our video ministry the other day where he was like, yeah, recently we've kind of figured out that we are really set up really well systematically for NewSpring in 2010 when we were half as big as we are right now. Yeah, our team right now used is this terrible combination of Wufoo Form, which is like an online form builder as a design request. Then that goes to a project manager who looks at the status sheet that we have for our team, which is a Google spreadsheet with all the designers and all the projects they're working on. It's real classy. She looks at that status sheet and she says, this person has margin or this person would be suited to work on that. And she forwards that design request email to the designer and adds it to the status sheet. And we communicate through Google Docs and email. And it worked really great for a while. We're drowning right now. We're doing a internal brand audit right now where basically I'm redoing the templates for everything that exists as we try and bring some clarity, which means I took in about 700 internal design requests. I can't even manage that stuff in my inbox, much less on a system. So eventually we'll probably build something, but that requires carving out time to build something. Yeah, absolutely.
Other questions? In the back?
Yeah, how do you go about when you just don't have the margin and you just really don't have the time? How does the process work when you have to say no to a ministry need or something comes in and like we have to have this in 4 days or 2 days or 1 day?
Yeah.
And sometimes there's marketing projects that legitimately by the execution of it, you actually physically don't have the time.
Right.
If you work 3 hours a day.
Right. So we, our team is, our communications design team is central, which means we handle every printed, web, whatever request for our entire church. We got 7 campuses right now. We're about to launch 3. So it's a lot of requests from a lot of ministries. We are very fond of saying we're not the no team, which is a ego blow to a designer to an extent, because sometimes we create solutions for ministries that we think are bad ideas. But our job is to serve that ministry. That is what colors everything we do. If I want to like wield my creative juices someplace, I'll go and do that someplace else. But within the context of our church culture on staff at NewSpring, we're there to serve them. So we don't want to say no to them ever, really. But legitimately, there are only so many hours in the day and only so many people there. We've done a lot of traveling to campuses with our team, explaining our process. We call them lunch and learns. We cater some Chick-fil-A and buy them some cupcakes and say, this is how we do things. This is why we do it. This is the volume of projects we have in right now. This is legitimately how long it takes to make a 20-page book. And just arm them with some information and then let them ask questions. That's been great for building equity with those ministries. We also, when we travel to campuses, serve. Like on a Sunday, if I travel to the Charleston campus, which is 4 hours away, I go and stay Saturday night and I wake up at 5 a.m. and I load in with them, just like the rest of their staff does. That's built a lot of relational equity too, so that it's not the designers in their ivory tower saying no because they don't want to do this. It's these people are serving alongside us. They legitimately want to get it done, but maybe they can't. So that said, we have a 2-week hard design time. And that's just design, that's not ordering, that's not delivery or installation. We need 2 weeks, and that's not because your dinky little sign takes 2 weeks, that's because every designer on our team has 200 other design requests right now. We try and explain that very well to people. And then there are always those times when it's like, they really do need it last minute, there's a legit need. It's not because they haven't planned well, it's just because something came up. You know, there was some opportunity that presented itself and they want it to be excellent, we want it to be excellent. We call it black market graphics when ministries do their own stuff. We don't want black market graphics, you know? We want to serve them. We hired you to do ministry, that you hired me to design things. Let me do my job. We want you to do your job. So in doing that, it's a phone call. We say, put in a design request, but call us, talk through it. We'll see what we can do. We'll see who has margin for it. And sometimes we just have to say no, or sometimes you're the ministry guy who everything is a last minute emergency. That's a conversation with that guy's and then that guy's boss. So
I saw a tweet go out the other day about blackmarketgraphics.com. It was weird. I wouldn't click the URL. Another question or two in the back?
Yep. Is affecting change?
Could you repeat that? So
yeah, basically, how do I feel like working at a large church is affecting change using the skills that I have? I think it's the same thing it did when we were a small church. I think that's part of my perspective on that is, I think it's really easy to be like, mega churches are this. And it's like, well, dude, my pastor, who has like a number one best-selling book this week, hired me in a Chick-fil-A in a rainstorm, and he was like, hey, what do you want to do with your life? I was like, oh, I don't know, get paid to make things pretty and make them better, I guess. So like, I know, like churches are made up of people. So whether they're big or small, I think it's just a matter of scale, honestly. So as a Christian, as a guy who's passionate about discipleship, especially, I want for our church to change the communities that we're in. I grew up in one of these small towns that like our church is in. I see dudes that I got blasted with in a field at a party in high school roll in and be like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, I work here, what are you doing here? And they're like, oh, I volunteer here now. And I'm like, that's changing our community. That's changing the place that I live and that I grew up in. There are difficulties with anything that's big. Change is difficult. Takes a long time to steer a big ship in a different direction. But I definitely don't think that just because we're big, we can't affect change. I think that because we're big, we have more of a platform to steward. And we have a greater responsibility to steward it really well and to be very careful about what we do and how we do it. But that doesn't mean that we can't do it. It's just a lot of work, and that's why we need people to work at it. So I feel like if I wasn't affecting change in a real way that affected people, not just like creating portfolio pieces, but creating like legit things that help people connect with our church, connect with the Bible, and connect with the gospel. If I wasn't doing, I didn't feel like we weren't doing that, I'd go someplace else.
Time for about one more, two more over here.
You've given us a sense of what your creative team composition is like. What's your development team like? And what's the collaboration
between the two partners? Yeah, so we're in an interesting leadership transition a bit on our team right now. Which is pretty constant that we're in a leadership transition. But I think I've hired everybody that's on our team now. So we have three developers on our staff right now. Two of them serve directly on our team. One of them reports up to a guy on senior leadership and is working on a church management system. We're collaborating with some other churches to build a church management system. So he's kind of like off on his own. These other two guys, one of them is the web director, I think is his title. He makes the decisions, a lot of the decisions I used to make, which is who are we gonna host with? What kind of structures are we gonna use there? We trust him to make those decisions. From a collaborative standpoint, I still make a lot of the decisions about user experience and user interaction and try and help ministry shape content for our websites too. And so we sit, I mean, our team sits on a big long table. So we just sit there and collaborate. It's not a, here's my Photoshop comp and now I'm gonna hand it off to you, build it exactly how I want you to build it because I know everything, because it's not true. So it's, usually for us, it's a lot of paper sketches because paper is free and it saves a lot of time. So a lot of paper sketches together, a lot of, like if we have a meeting with a ministry about a web strategy or an initiative, there's always a project manager, a designer, and a developer in there because we need all of those viewpoints equally. Ultimately, somebody's got to make the final say, but we respect each other a lot, so it works very well.